Station number 11369. Commander Peter Walpole, Reel 1 of 5.
Lieutenant Commander Peter Walpole, Reel 1. And if I could ask you first of all, Peter, you know, how long had you been in the Navy when the Falklands issue blew up? And I wondered, you know, why you went into the Navy in the first place.
Well, I joined straight from school in September 1974. And then subsequently went on a nomination scheme to university for 3 years, which I enjoyed very much. Why I joined, obviously people who join the military have many reasons. I actually come from an army family, so I was well aware of the travel and benefits of being in the service, enjoyed that. And also we'd been quite a sailing family, had lots of sailing trips, and so I got a fair affinity for the water and decided the Navy seemed like a good option. After that, having joined the Navy, which to me seemed like an extension of school when I first went to college, bells rang and people queued for meals and you did things before breakfast and played lots of sport. So I felt I wanted something more and was very pleased to go to university sponsored by the Navy. And then after that, completed the various courses you need to become an officer of the watch. And then joined a minesweeper in Scotland, based in Scotland, that was doing fishery protection duties. And did that for about a year and a half. But I suffered tremendously from seasickness, so asked if I could perhaps be on a slightly bigger ship. And also I didn't find it a particularly happy period and was considering a career outside the Navy at the same time. Well, having left the minesweeper in Scotland, I then joined HMS Sheffield in February of 1981 as the signal communications officer. And we then conducted a series of exercises and training prior to November 1981, when we deployed to the Gulf Patrol, our Miller as it's known, to look after the interests of British shipping in the Gulf region during the Iran-Iraq War. So that's where the bit starts, really.
At the time of the Falklands crisis, when things were brewing up, what were you actually doing? Could you tell me, first of all, about your ship and the class of ship?
Well, Sheffield herself was the first of a new class of destroyers that became known as the Sheffield class, amongst other things, but actually is the Type 42 destroyer. And I think the Sheffield was built by Vickers. And at the time that it was that the Falklands was brewing, I think really we were relatively oblivious because a lot of the things that were related, like the Knot Defence Review and the decision to do away with the ice patrol ship, we didn't necessarily see as being things related to some future potential conflict. And really the business of the scrap dealers and South Georgia, which happened in April of 82, took place when we were in Gibraltar and just leaving Gibraltar on our way back from the Armilla Patrol. So that really was just before things we noticed. And the one thing I remember was looking at a Sunday newspaper, one of those enormously fat pieces of felled forest. And I think the covers were all about the scrap dealers in South Georgia, but to us it didn't at the time seem as if it was going to build into a war. It just looked like another diplomatic problem.
And you were on the exercises, were you, in Gibraltar?
Well, we were due to join an exercise that I think was called Spring Train, and there were a large gathering of ships in Gibraltar that included also an admiral and his staff, who subsequently became the admiral leading the British effort at sea. So, yes, we sailed and took part in some of the exercises, but having been away for 5 months, we were all quite convinced we were going home, and our place was back at UK in a few days' time, but that all changed.
Can you remember your first awareness that you might be involved in something big?
Newspaper articles had caused some mild alarm, the full significance of it had not really come home to us at that stage. And certainly by the time we sailed, this was before the Argentinians had landed in the Falklands. So I suppose the first time we became aware that we were going to be involved was while the exercise was really filtering out, or petering out, and the staff asked everyone to begin planning for an out-of-area deployment. And it pretty soon became clear that the majority of the ships involved in the exercise were actually going to be turned south as part of a force to counter the threat that we perceived in the Falklands.
So what was the mood like in the Sheffield when you heard of this?
Well, obviously we were all very keen to go home after 5 months, and it was difficult to get to grips with the fact that we were being sent south, especially as we'd almost got so close and yet we were so far away from getting home. There was some feeling that perhaps we should at least go somewhere and drop off all the kit we had on board, the stuff that really was not essential for war. We really just rallied behind Captain Sam Salt, who, as you know, is our captain at the time. And he was the one who would break the news that we were going to continue with the deployment. But I think perhaps an attitude of sadness at not being able to go home, but of resolve, and also the hope that the politicians would sort the mess out in very short time, and that really it would just be a delay to our return to UK.
Were any exceptions made, you know, for the crew for compassionate reasons? You know, were some of them sent home?
I honestly can't remember, but if there were, there would have only been one or two. As we sailed further south, I think the civilians on board the ship, which are the NAFI personnel and the Chinese laundrymen, were given the option of either staying or going home. And I seem to remember that one of the Chinese laundrymen did go home, but the other one decided to stick it out.
So could I ask you now about, you know, setting off in the and joining the task force, and what the role of the Sheffield would have been? Did you join up, for instance, with the others of your class, your sister ships?
Well, obviously the group itself was essentially formed during the exercise, so in that sense we were already joined up. The role of HMS Sheffield, she was an air defence unit, as are all the Type 42 destroyers. So her prime function is to detect air contacts and engage those who come within range, and the conduct of the air battle as well.
South, would there have been any sort of cross-decking, you know, with because not all the ships, I understand, from the jib exercises went to the Falklands?
Yes, that is true, although cross-decking was not quite so much personnel, more equipment and ammunition, and those who were going back to UK basically gave up their remaining stocks of ammunition, as much as we could carry, and food and really anything else that we needed. So yes, there was a large amount of transfer of stores and ammunition, but I don't think personnel, certainly if not from our ship, there may have been from others.
Was that a long operation, that cross-decking, as you recall?
I honestly can't remember. I suppose a couple of days in total before we finally parted company and went our ways.
On a personal level, you know, did you send things to your family?
We realised that that was an opportunity for sending mail, so we did tend to take every single one we could.
What were your expectations, would you say, at this stage, you know, as you were going south? Can you remember how they changed from would seem mild annoyance at first to...
Yes, all along we hoped that the political initiatives, which we followed intently, would bring a peaceful solution. And as time passed and it became apparent that things like the Hague Shuttle and the various UN initiatives that were being taken were not bringing a substantial change to the position. In other words, the Argentinians remained on the islands and were not going. I think there it began to change from the mild annoyance that you rightly indicate to the hope that the presence of a reasonably sized naval force would do something to deter them.
How did you get this information?
BBC World Service mainly. When I was on watch, I would always make sure that the World Service was plugged to the bridge so that we could listen to the news reports. And it's curious now that the initial signature tune that comes at the front of the World Service news reports would signal perhaps hope or perhaps sadness or a sort of sense of fate, but we would always listen to it very carefully to see if there was any sign of things improving as far as we were concerned. Hopefully a diplomatic solution, which is obviously what everyone wanted.
Well, was there no sense of sort of jingoism on the Sheffield?
Well, I'm not quite sure perhaps what the proper definition of jingoism is. We certainly...
The keenness to go, you know, the sort of keenness to get involved in the sort of things you've been trained for, or seemingly you've been trained for.
Now, I'm not sure that was the way the ship's company and certainly I was feeling, and obviously speaking mainly for myself, I sort of felt that we were well equipped and had been well trained to deal with whatever might come along, but that while we would do whatever we could, if it came to military action, it was with a certain reluctance, as if it really was the last option available. And in that sense, I don't think there was a great desire to go in and slay 1,000 Argentinians for the sake of it.
Yes, it's interesting you're talking about training, and you indicate that you had confidence that you had been trained for what you were going into.
Yes, and interestingly enough, that sense never really left the Navy, and certainly after the conflict, everyone did feel that, yes, there are some changes we must make to reflect modern warfare, but that essentially the training that we give people and the way we run the Navy is a sound basis. And I think perhaps more than anything on the personnel side, that the good leaders of men still demand and receive a lot of respect, and sailors will follow them. And I think Captain Sam Salt's a classic example.
Yes, I must ask you about Sam Salt. I think it's a wonderful name for a captain.
He's an admiral now.
An admiral, yes. You're talking about the training again. Am I not right in thinking, though, that you had been trained with Russia, you know, that sort of element as the enemy, if I can put it that way?
Well, certainly the a lot of the structure for finding out about the enemy, in other words, the intelligence organisation, was geared against Russia, and so we would certainly have done a lot of our training against the then perceived threat, the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union. But I think a lot of the basic principles about shooting down a missile that's coming towards you are essentially the same. I think the difference is that in dealing with Western technology, which is what the Argentinians had, the problem, if anything, was more sophisticated, but not in the sort of numbers that the Russians could throw against you. So a different problem. But I think, really, the thing that we lacked in many ways was intelligence. So many of us just had to refer to Jane's fighting ships as our source of information. And what may have been a small neglected desk in the Ministry of the South American threat suddenly became the centre of everyone's attention.
But did you expect more from submarines, you know, because of the accent on Russia, would you say? It was
from Argentinian submarines?
Yes, rather than their air power.
Well,
Or had your training sort of focused you on that direction rather than...
Well, I think there's different things there. The Sheffield, being an air defence ship, would obviously want to concentrate on the thing that she would be most capable of dealing with, which would be the air threat. And their aircraft, certainly essentially Western aircraft. But we were also aware that she had, the Argentine had acquired some very sophisticated and very difficult to detect German submarines, some small ones. So they also constituted a threat. And perhaps we'll come on to the day in question when submarine threat was certainly something that I was concerned about on the day.
Am I right in thinking that Sheffield was armed with Sea Dart?
That's correct, yeah.
Yes. And did you have confidence in Sea Dart, you know, in the light of the exercises you had been on?
Yes, we'd conducted successful high seas firings and achieved the aim in engaging the targets within the required criteria. And I felt confident in the warfare team, who seemed very competent at their jobs, and well led by the captain, and with the crew who seemed to have done well together. And unlike other ships, who perhaps had only recently acquired members of their ship's company, we had all been together for the whole 5-month deployment, and as a consequence, we're very welded together team.
A happy ship.
Oh yes, very happy.
Could you tell me something about the then captain, Sam Salt? What sort of a person he was?
Well, he'd joined us in Mombasa during the a maintenance period halfway through the Gulf Patrol. So really he'd only been on board a couple of months before the arrival in Gibraltar and the subsequent deployment. But in a very short space of time, he'd won the hearts and minds of the ship's company and built up a good following amongst all of us. I found him a delightful man to work with.
Is that very important, do you think, you know, the sort of relationship between the top commander of a ship, the captain, and not only the officers but the other ranks as well, you know, sort of relationship?
Yes, I think very much so in ships, because you're all so close, and the captain's personality is, along with other, to a slightly lesser extent, other key personnel on board, has a great deal to play in morale and general conduct of the ship. It is very important.
So it would seem that you were a happy ship, a cohesive ship, and you had confidence in...
We had reasonable confidence in what we were going to, what the task ahead was, should it come to that.
As you steamed south, did you go to Ascension Island? You had to call...
Yes, we did.
Ascension.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Ascension was really a last staging post, if you like, and it provided the opportunity to, on a personal note, to send mail home. Some of the last that we did manage to get home. There was a desire amongst many of us to land a lot of equipment from the Sheffield. After 5 months of touring around the Gulf, you tend to get laden down with what sailors call rabbits, the things you buy in all the foreign ports, be they wooden animals in Kenya, exchanged for a T-shirt on the jetty, or gifts and things that you had acquired. And my cabin was an Aladdin's den of goodies from around the Indian Ocean. And that and many other items, perhaps considered superfluous for warfare, be they carpets or upper deck awnings to shade the ship in hot climates, were all considered for landing. But I think really there was a general feeling that there wasn't enough capacity to sort all the stuff out and send it ashore. There was no effort to be kept safely in Ascension, and there really wasn't time.
So that had to go with you, all your rabbits?
Oh, it all came with us, yes.
And presumably it was lost?
Oh, yes, yes. I like to think that the several crates of beer that was in my cabin probably exploded at some critical time in the fire and helped cool it temporarily.
The fuel situation, you know, all this time, obviously it's a very vast journey. And I wonder how you were sort of reacting to this. Did it suddenly seem a very big place, the ocean, Atlantic Ocean?
I think sailors generally have a fair concept of how how big the world is, because we trog along at a steady speed and we know how many days it takes us to get there, and I think that concept's been with sailors for many a century. But certainly, as our focus shifted to the South Atlantic, we would look at exactly where this place was and see how far down the bottom of the world it seemed to be. We had a chart on the bridge that would basically show where we were. It was a chart of the entire Atlantic. And ship's company would come up to the bridge and have a look and see where we were. So we had a pretty good idea of how far it was to go. It's a long way.
Did it seem a long way from home or base?
Yes, I think really it felt further after we had gone through the tropics, because having spent 5 months in the Indian Ocean wearing our tropical uniform, the white shorts and everything, and having got to Gibraltar, we then headed south and went back through the tropics, changed back into tropical uniform, wearing the white shorts, and enjoying the sunshine, as Ascension is really just south of the equator. And then as we carried on further south, it really began to feel much further as the weather reflected the fact that we were going into southern ocean.
And what was your position in the task force generally?
I honestly can't remember. We would have been one of the screening units, no doubt, somewhere towards the outer edge of the group, looking at conducting surveillance of the air and the surface. But I don't remember the detail.
Would you have been conscious of being part of a task force?
Oh yes, very much so.
In a physical sense.
Yes, either by when other ships' helicopters come and visit you, or come and collect people, or deliver people, or exchange goods, and also because we could see the other ships. Certainly the ones closest.
How about training as you were going south? Did you have lots of training exercises?
I think the training that you can conduct, well, it was certainly fairly limited. We didn't have simulated sort of Argentinian attacks on us or anything. It was really a question of reviewing what we had to do and looking through the general instructions for going to war, be they issuing new style of identity cards and briefing people on the Geneva Convention and considering such things as lifting carpets and stuff like that, and whether or not to shave off our beards, depending on whether or not there's a chemical threat as the beard breaks the seal around the gas mask. We were saved on that one because I actually had a beard at the time, and so did the first lieutenant, and he took the executive decision that there wasn't going to be a chemical threat, so we all kept our beards, which was rather nice.
It's a very interesting point, that, isn't it? It would seem a very small point, but it could be important.
Yes, so they say it's considered to be important. I gather everyone in the Hermes had to shave off. They decided there was a threat. So really, in terms of the training, it was a question of looking at the general instructions and seeing the sort of preparations that one could make. I remember that the officer watch was issued with a tin hat, a helmet, on which he chalked battle bowler. And we did certainly try and keep ourselves amused and entertained and keep our spirits up. And I remember we had sort of a little reception on the bridge wing. I forget what the occasion was. It may have been someone's birthday. We all drunk Pims at lunchtime on the bridge wing, which was very nice. And the officer watch came and joined us wearing his battle bowler, joking slightly. I think there was a slight sort of feeling that still that the politicians are going to sort this lot out and that we would only make as many preparations as we really had to. So things were fairly upbeat among some people, though there was this heavy cloud of, well, if they don't sort it out, then we really are going to have to fight.
How about the intelligence situation? You know, as you were going south, did you have more briefings?
Yes, I think really, given that the Argentinians are armed or were armed essentially with Western equipment that probably some of the our allies who'd supplied them with equipment were able to give us a little more information on what they had sold. For instance, the French, who obviously had sold them quite a lot of kit. And I think some of the older ships they had were American. And there were other ships in NATO who had the same class and were able to give a little bit more information. But it was very much a question of scrabbling around to see what we could find.
Did you have a visit from Admiral Woodward?
Yes, we did. And he'd actually been one of the early captains of HMS Sheffield, so it was a return to his one of his old ships. Yes, he came on board, and the one thing I do remember is gathering of officers and senior aides in the wardroom, and he sat on a chair the wrong way round, as in a fairly John Wayne manner, and gave us a chat. I wasn't sure if it was a sort of a chin-up chat or if it was a look, it's going to be quite tough type chat. So I was left with no firm impression one way or the other when he'd gone.
Is one allowed to sort of cross-examine an admiral on those occasions? Can you ask questions?
Oh yes, very much so. I mean, it was commendably informal, and he was very much open to question, which I thought was very nice. I think it was almost a Nelsonian touch to say, come on chaps, what do you want to ask me? Obviously he was limited in what he knew, simply because we were essentially in the hands of politicians. But it was nice to at least see the face, so we knew who was guiding us.
Yes, talking of Nelson, was there ever any feeling that this was going to be another Trafalgar, in so far as you know?
No, I think perhaps the first realisation that what was happening or what happened subsequently would be part of history was in a letter my father wrote saying that you may not realise it now, son, but what you're doing is part of history. And I sort of thought, oh, really? I suppose really the thing about being so far away in the South Atlantic is that, of course, we didn't have newspapers. We were not privy to the discussions that the average Englishman was having in the pub about bumping off Argies or bombing Buenos Aires or whatever. And we had just the BBC World Service, which is a very down-the-middle, factual, and almost downbeat sort of conversation, the way they give the news. So I think a lot of the sentiment that was in UK, we were not actually receiving.
It's very interesting, I think, you know, the comment of your father and your reaction to it. You know, does this teach you yourself anything about history, the nature of history?
Yes, I suppose that many people don't realise it's happening when it is, and it takes someone a bit further away to appreciate it. I think it's the same as those people who happen to be, I don't know, in Dallas when JFK was shot. They probably didn't realise that would be a crucial point in the world's history.